Dear students of my course, this is part 7, lecture 7 of the Network Science course. Please open PhD SEM 7 PowerPoint file, and then you will see the title slide, which is Networks and Stability, part 7, Examples for Networks, Organelles, Neurons and Social Networks. This will be the concluding part of the three lectures, which are summarizing the examples for networks for yourself, starting with the cell organelle networks. As I mentioned to you two lectures before, at the summary, the cell organelle networks are actually having nodes as cellular organelles, like mitochondria, for example, or endoplasmic reticulum, or nuclear membrane, or plasma membrane, or peroxisomes, or many other organelles in the cellular compartments, and these organelles are actually connected by membrane vesicles or membrane channels in each of our cells. You have the mitochondrial network, for example, in a cardiomyocyte, and if you are having a danger, which is at the bottom of these slides, of this figure, the blue images of this figure, in the middle of these blue images, there is a rectangle, and this rectangle is showing you the part when this cardiomyocyte or cardiac tissue was damaged by oxidative damage, where this cardiac tissue is becoming white, that is becoming dead, and you can see that this damage is actually spreading around in this cardiac tissue, which, as you know it very well, it's a syncytium, so therefore it is a single cell or it is a kind of amalgamated amount of various cardiomyocytes. And the mitochondria of these cardiomyocytes are connected with each other. So here, those mitochondria which are becoming white are becoming dead, and as you can see, the damage is propagating from the mitochondria where the damage was introduced. So this means that those mitochondria were actually connected with other neighboring mitochondria, and you can see that the neighboring mitochondria were damaged largely by this oxidative damage. However, very interestingly, the damage is not propagating evenly everywhere, because first, not all mitochondria are connected to each other. Second, most importantly, mitochondria can dissociate these networks from each other if they observe that the neighboring mitochondrium is becoming damaged, because they would like to protect themselves. And there are mechanisms which are dissociating these networks. And this is actually a very important mechanism to save these networks. It is not only happening in mitochondria, but it is also happening in ourselves. Think about our social networks at the coronavirus. We are dissociating our social networks. We are making social distances not to spread the virus to each other. So we are doing the very same as the mitochondria are doing here at the cardiomyocytes if they are damaged. The next slide is showing you actually the ways how mitochondria can be actually associated. They actually can be fused with each other eventually, so associated fully. And it is happening that damaged mitochondria are fused with healthy mitochondria, and it is administered in a way that the damaged mitochondria will be repaired by the healthy mitochondria, and not vice versa. Not the dead mitochondria or the healthy mitochondria will be damaged by the damaged one. Now, in the next slide, I'm showing you some biomolecular condensates. This is a fairly recent advance in biochemical sciences and in cell biological sciences. And you can see that there are not only the regular cellular organelles, what I listed to you before, that for example the nucleus or the plasma membrane, but there are many other biomolecular condensates, which are large protein complexes like the RNA transport granule or the stress granule or the germ granule or the PML body and all the others what are listed here, and the number of these biomolecular condensates are increasing, and this is a very exciting part of modern and recent biochemistry and cellular biology. So keep an eye on that. The next network what I would like to introduce to you is the next slide, the neural networks. Here the nodes are neurons, and the edges are connections between the neurons, for example by synapses, but by other ways as well. These networks are also small word networks, so neurons can be reached from any neuron within a few steps as an average. This means that our ideas can be transmitting large distances in our brain, and the neurons can form actually shortcuts between different brain regions, and those can actually give us quite creative ideas in our way of thinking. This network is also scale-free, so there are neurons which are hubs and which are associated with many other neurons, but most of the neurons are not hubs. This is important because if you are a hub, or if you are a neuron and you are becoming a hub, then you are overloaded with information. So only a few neurons can stand this, and there must be several glial cells helping these neurons to survive. So we cannot maintain a neuronal network when each of the neurons is a hub, because that will be very costly and very, very dangerous, because our neurons could be damaged. These neuronal networks are also modular. Obviously, there are groups of neurons which are actually encoding various memory traces and various procedures or memories which we have in our brain or in our neuronal network. And those modules are connected, and these connections are again giving us quite some creativity. Now, networks of human neurons can be constructed in many ways. One of the way how you can construct is indirect. But let me ask first about the magnitude of this task. How many nodes and edges are in the human brain? What do you think? Now, the answer is that there are 10 billion neurons approximately, or even more, so practically as many neurons as we are on the Earth almost right now. And what is even more important, as an average, they have 50 to 100,000 contacts. So think about that. A hub, when it is a protein hub, is having 100 contacts, or maybe 300 contacts. Now these neurons are having 50,000 or 100,000 contacts. This is a large difference. How this might happen? This is the wonder, the beautiful trick of evolution when it invented neurons. Neurons have axons and dendrites. And this axon and dendrite structure is a large and huge protrusion of the neuron. So the surface of the neuron is extremely large as compared to a surface of a simple protein, even with these protrusions, or as compared to our surface, human beings. So a neuron can have 50,000 connections physically at the same time. We would never have 50,000 connections physically at the same time, not even virtually. I mean, I don't think that any of you has 50,000 friends or acquaintances, friends. We couldn't talk about friends if you are talking such high numbers. Acquaintances at the same time, it's quite impossible. But neurons do have this number of neighbors. So this is the real trick of neurons, and we are inventing or examining this huge and complex structure by reverse engineering. We are figuring out the parts from the whole, and the idea is behind this that we are examining the activity of the neurons, and we are using the Hebbian principle. If two neurons are active at the same time, that they are mostly or they are more quite likely to be connected physically or functionally, and therefore it is kind of enough to measure which neurons are active at the same time at different exposures or different times of the brain function. And as the brain is thinking about different things, or there are different things happening around the brain, different regions are becoming active. But you can measure which regions are becoming active at the same time. And if you are examining these regions very carefully, then you can actually design, or you can actually figure out which neurons are connected, because they are becoming active at the same time, and that means that they are somehow connected, either directly or indirectly, but relatively closely. Now, this actually gives us in the brain, but also in protein-protein interaction networks, inhibition and activation zones. I'm giving you just a very simple example in the left side of this figure, which is the example of protein-protein interactions in the yeast network or in any other networks, but this was the yeast interactome actually. We call these networks interactomes. This is a very important word actually. So what was administered here? There was a twofold increase administered by overexpression of a protein in this yeast protein-protein interaction network, and then they measured actually the free concentration of the neighbors of this protein. And obviously, if you increase the concentration of a certain protein, then its neighbors will have a decreased free concentration. And remember or listen, this is free concentration, what I'm talking about right now. This is obvious, because if the neighbor, their neighbor has an increased concentration, they have to bind to that neighbor more. Therefore, their free concentration, remaining free concentration, is decreasing. Now, just think about it. If you have a central protein which has an increased concentration, then its direct neighbors have a decreased concentration. However, the second neighbors, because of this, have an increased free concentration, and so on. So there is a wave going around this protein, which is having zones of inhibition, like the direct neighbors, and zones of activation, like the second neighbors, and then inhibition, like the third layer. And obviously this is fading away as you are going farther away from the central protein. But this is actually observed in the neuronal structure as well. There was an experimentally stimulated neuron, and in the vicinity there was an increased amount of excited neurons, obviously, because they were becoming excited because they were connected. But in their vicinity, there was an amount of inhibited neurons. And this is very interesting. This is a very peculiar and very important structural feature of the neuronal network, that it is sparing us. As I mentioned to you, if all neurons are becoming active at the same time, that is an epileptic seizure, that is damaging our brain. That is not an idea. That is something of a confusion. You don't have ideas when you have an epileptic seizure. You have a complete nonsense. You have a breakout. So inhibition must accompany activation in the neuronal network to make things discriminatable, to make ideas born. And this is a very important feature of the neuronal network. Now, in the next slide, I am giving you an example of the memory. And obviously, as I mentioned to you, our memory is encoded by neighboring neurons, by segments of the neuronal network. Not very many neurons are actually necessary to encode a certain engram, to encode a certain memory piece, segment. Only a few neurons are enough, maybe 10 or 20, but not thousands of neurons. For simple memory clues, there are only a few neurons are enough. Obviously not two or three, because this is a dynamic entity, so these are changing, but not that many, actually. Now, this actually gives us the functional consequence that our memory is context dependent. So, for example, if there were medical students, like most of you, or dentistry students, then they were asked to memorize a poem, and they were asked to memorize this poem under some circumstances. This was a very difficult experiment, actually. They were asked to memorize the poem at the time they were examining a patient. I don't know how they did it, but this experiment was done by psychologists, actually. So they were actually trying to memorize this poem while examining a patient. And then they were asked to rehearse, to tell this poem. And they were asked to tell this poem while drinking beer, for example, in a pub, or while examining a patient. And not surprisingly, they could remember much more to the poem than they were examining a patient again. So they had the same context, because their memory was context-dependent. Now, this was actually experimented by several other occasions, like with alcoholics. And if you are happen to be an alcoholic, I hope not, then it is actually happening that if you hide an additional amount of alcohol while you were detoxicated, you will not remember to that when you are sober. But if you become slightly detoxicated, obviously not if you are becoming completely detoxicated, then you start to remember to that, because the context is now appearing. So I usually tell to my students that if you are coming to an exam and you were happening to drink a little bit while you were preparing to the exam, then please drink before the exam as well. But obviously this is a bad example, because alcohol is damaging your brain, so don't use it very often or very extensively. Now, my next slide is giving you another aspect of this cellular or memory networks, giving you the idea that a greater self-complexity is actually buffering stress. So what is happening? If you have only one identity, your identity is your single identity, that you are a medical student here at the Semmelweis University, for example, and you have no other identities, that is dangerous, let me tell you, because then if you fail in an exam, that is very much empowering you, and you cannot really get out of it very easily. On the other hand, if you have several other identities, that you are, for example, a Dutchman, or you are coming from the United States, or you have some hobbies, like you like playing tennis, for example, or you like chess, or you like listen to certain classical music, then you can switch a little bit your identity from being a medical student to a chess player or a tennis player or a music listener or other, and then you can overcome to your problems which were given to you in a certain identity of yours. So this is that greater self-complexity is indeed buffering stress. But be cautious if your identities are very numerous, so you have 100 identities because you are doing so many things at the same time, that is not healthy. So the amount approximately the 15 or a dozen or 10 is around the optimum. Obviously, each person has a different optimum, but this is actually helping you a lot if it is an optimal amount. Now, the next network I'm showing to you is the Wood Wide Web, which is an interesting network. It is experienced in the forests. The real part of the forest is not the tree, what you see. That might be surprising to you. The real part of the forest is below the earth. Hopes. This is interesting. Why is it so? Because trees are connected. Their roots are connected by fungi. And these roots of the trees are actually exchanging goodies, actually exchanging metabolites with each other. So if a tree is experiencing stress, like it is experiencing an extreme amount of UV light because it is on the sunshine, then it is damaged. Neighboring trees, which are experiencing less stress because they are covered by a cloud and they are on the shade or in the shade, then they are not that much damaged. So they are actually providing the damaged tree with some nutrients, which is helping to survive. For example, free radical molecules which are capturing free radicals. So molecules which have many double bonds, for example. These are provided by those trees which are not endangered to those trees which are endangered by the UV light. On the other hand, those trees which are on the light are producing energy. So they are providing energy to those trees which are providing them medication. So there is a large market down there below the earth as an exchange of various goodies between the trees. Let's speak about, for example, that you have lost your mobile phone. And your mobile phone was buried in the ground in a forest after a while. And your mobile phone is containing several rare chemicals, like molybdenum, for example. Molybdenum is very important for the trees. But molybdenum is relatively rare in the forest because there are not that many mobile phones buried in the forest. So believe me, if a tree is finding a mobile phone, then the tree is becoming very happy, actually, because it is a rich source of molybdenum and other rare chemicals. So that tree is distributing these chemicals to the neighboring trees, and the neighboring trees are giving this tree food as an exchange. So there is a big market in the forest, and that's why the forest is so resilient and can survive. The market, the information exchange, is not only below the earth but above the earth as well. The right side of the figure is showing you information exchange between plants, trees, above the earth. Now, this is in the form of volatile chemicals, like small molecules. And these molecules are signaling, for example, danger. Like, if a tree is becoming consumed by an animal, that is, tree is becoming damaged. But that tree is exposing or emitting a danger signal to the neighboring trees that please be prepared that there is an animal coming, and this animal might start to eat you as well. So the neighboring trees are getting to be prepared. How can they be prepared? They are starting to synthesize molecules which are covering the wounds. So if the animal is starting to eating them, then they can cover the wounds quite easily and quickly. On the other hand, if they are more sophisticated or more clever, then they start to synthesize chemicals which have a bitter taste. If the animal is approaching them, it is experiencing a bitter taste. Now, why is not the tree bitter? Producing this bitter taste all the time? Well, this is costing the tree energy. So why the hell the tree would produce this bitter molecule if there are no animals around? That is not very efficient. So most of the trees are producing these bitter taste molecules only if there is an animal around, and this is why they are very happy to form a forest, because those trees which are on the side of the forest or which are damaged by the animal can signal to the other trees that here is an animal which is damaging us, so please be prepared. So this is actually pretty much the same what we are doing as human beings when we are warning each other about the coronavirus or about any other dangers which we have around us, and we are preparing a medication or a remedy against this. So the simple organisms are behaving quite similarly than ourselves. Now one more slide about life below the earth. I just would like to warn you or give you the data. The most important part of the biomass on Earth is not above the Earth, but below the Earth. Above the Earth, those are those green things, which is on the top of the slide. And above, below the Earth, those are those brownish things, which are below, which are on the bottom of the slide. So you can see that the brownish things have many more volumes and masses as a biomass than those on the top. So be cautious about this. Below your feet, the life starts, actually. So the most important of the life is not above the earth, but below the earth. Now, my next slide is showing you a social network of animals. Actually, dolphins, which are very intelligent animals. These dolphins were forming social networks, so each of the dots here is a dolphin. The round ones, I think, are females. The rectangle ones are males, if I'm correct. And the edges are social connections between the dolphins, which were measured actually by physical distances. Those dolphins which were socially connected were usually in the vicinity of each other for a long time, with a large probability. Now, this dolphin network is a small world, so dolphins can be reached from any other dolphins very easily in this network. And there are some bridges, like those dolphins which were highlighted. These are three dolphins in this network. And actually what had happened in this particular case, that during the time of observation, which was 1 year, or more than half a year, these three dolphins were vanishing, were going to a different place, to some weeks or months during this period. And during this time, this larger dolphin network was dissociated to two subnetworks, because these dolphins were the dolphins which were connecting this social network of dolphins. But then they returned, and this gave this experiment a very important part. And when they returned, then this dolphin network, the large one, was reassociated again. And all the dolphins were coming or going together again. So this was a very rare example, what you can observe in nature. But this was a very important example to show us the importance of bridges, even at dolphin networks. Now, my next network, which I'm showing to you, is the Erdős net. Pál Erdős was a mathematician of Hungarian origin, and he was a very creative mathematician in very different areas of mathematics, actually. Now, because of this reason, he had many co-authors during his life. Actually, altogether, 509 co-authors. Most of us who are scientists have only a few co-authors. I probably have 100 co-authors as maximum. I haven't counted it, but certainly not 509, like Pál Erdős. That is an exceptionally high number. And this Erdős net is actually having these co-authors associated with each other, and if they have a paper where they are co-authors in the paper, then they are connected. Now, this is giving the definition of the Erdős number, actually. If someone is a co-author of Pál Erdős, so among these 509 people, then he or she is having an Erdős number of 1. Who is having an Erdős number of 2, that is the co-author of these people, and so on and so on. So you can actually calculate an Erdős number of yourself if you are a scientist. Now, the question is, what I'm putting to you, that where is Pál Erdős on this figure? And please have a little pause here in the lecture and think about it for a while. And the correct answer is that Pál Erdős is nowhere on this figure, because if Pál Erdős would be here, then each of the other nodes should be connected to Pál Erdős, so there should be a large mega hub in this network, but we don't see any large mega hubs which is connected with all the nodes in this particular network, so Pál Erdős is missing from this network. Well, Pál Erdős is already in another dimension, as you can see in the next slide, from 1996, when he was deceased. Now, my next example is the traffic network of the United States, and this is actually not the real traffic network, but a modeled, simulated traffic network of the United States. There were two parameters of this simulation. The first parameter were the major hubs of the United States traffic network, which are the major cities of the United States, as you can see here on this figure. This first parameter was actually the distance between these mega cities of the United States. The second parameter was the number of changes of directions, and if the second parameter was low, practically zero, so all what was counted was the distance between the various mega cities of the United States, then you got back the highway structure of the United States pretty well. So if you are traveling on a highway, then it is not very important if you have to make one turn or two turns time to time. However, if you increase the weight of this parameter to 0.8, then you will have a completely different structure of this traffic net, and actually this completely different structure is very much resembling to the air traffic structure of the United States, which is having some decent hubs like Kansas City, like Atlanta, and some others all around in the United States. And now you may understand it, that when you are traveling by air, it is not indifferent how many times you have to change planes during your travel, because it is very time consuming. So therefore you would like to limit to change your planes to a minimum number, and this is giving you a completely different network. And you don't really care about the distance, what you have to cover that much in this particular case, but you do care about the number of changes, the number of direction changes. So that is a quite different traffic network, which is the air traffic network of the United States. So with this example, I wanted to show you that with a very simple representation and a very simple simulation, you can actually simulate different traffic networks very well, and this gives you the background that very simple ideas, very simple factors are operating behind the organization of these networks in different sets. Now, giving further examples in social networks, I'm just giving you the drama scenes of a Shakespearean drama of Troilus and Cressida, actually. And these drama scenes, the actors of the drama are the nodes, and the co-occurrences of the actors at a given scene, or mentioning of one actor, the other actors in different scenes, like scene 1, scene 2, and scene 3, are visualized by straight lines, solid lines, or dotted lines. So if one actor is mentioning the other one, that is visualized by a dotted line. And you can see that actually this is a smaller network, and therefore you can easily discriminate its groups, which are the different scenes, but these groups are becoming connected. So you are actually having the same actor in different scenes appearing, but not all the actors are appearing as the same in different scenes. So the actors which are connecting the scenes are connecting the story. So it is giving you a continuous story in this Shakespearean drama. So the drama is very well constructed because it is giving you a smaller network. And that is very important. Now, my next example is the example of predictions, human predictions. And in fact, human predictions are Hobbes. So a fact which is very much convincing to you is convincing because it is a neighbor of many other facts which have been convincing to you previously. So if you would like to convince someone about your ideas, then you have to connect your idea with ideas, other ideas, some of them, which are well accepted by that particular person. And if you are successful in that, then that person will accept your idea and will agree with you. So this is actually an important take-home message for negotiations, which you can actually use. Now, my next example is about scientific judgments. So not your judgment, general judgments, but scientific judgments, and it has been shown that they are not independent as well. Scientific judgments are very much influenced by the literature which was published before. So if an artifact was published in the literature, then it is very dangerous because it is affecting the opinion of scientists later on. And if an artifact was published quite frequently because people were believing that other scientists were correct, who published this artifact, then it is becoming the common knowledge. But it is not true. And it did happen sometimes in science, and that's quite bad. So you have to be very careful if you are doing science, that please don't become influenced by other scientists very much, because the facts, the scientific facts, are the only factors which should influence you if you are a scientist. My last example is the example of the judgments in US elections, actually. In some elections, actually formerly, I think, in the United States, the images, the faces, the portraits, pictures of the candidates were on the voting slips. If that was happening, so the voters were very much knowing the faces of the candidates, which is happening in most of the elections in many cases, what was observed, if the candidate was a male, so was a man, then the face of the candidate was actually determining pretty much the outcome of the election. If the face of the candidate was round shaped, then the candidate was likely to lose the election. If the face of the candidate, if the candidate was a man, was rectangle shaped, then the candidate was likely to win the election. Now, well, this is sounding very awkward or very funny. Why is it so? Because if the candidate was round shaped, had a round shaped face, then it was more likely, more similar to a baby face. And if you are a baby and you are a man, then people are thinking that you are not competent enough. If you have a rectangle shaped face, then you are more mature, you are more masculine, and people are thinking that you are more competent, and then you are more likely to win the elections. So if you would like to start an election process, then you might shape your hairstyle to make it more rectangle, and that will actually increase your chances to win the election. Obviously, this is not that simple, so I don't want to mislead you, but I just would like to warn you, or warn us, that our way of thinking is very much prone to network context, to various subliminal messages what we have about the face, or about the previous scientific facts, or about any other things. And we have to be very careful when we are making our judgments. So this was the end of the lecture, and we have two lectures left in this network science course, and I will give you some dynamic aspects, some aspects of the network dynamics in this last concluding two lectures. See you there.